But we begin today. It is the problem of violence. Somebody gets shot, stabbed, slapped upside the head, brick thrown up against them, concrete block, you name it. Doctors have to put them together. The paramedics grab them, and they take them, if it's really serious, to the state's number one trauma center, only trauma center in town, and that is over at Eskenazi Hospital and has a new fancy name, the Smith Level 1 Shock Trauma Center. And if that don't explain what it is they do, nothing does. We have the chief of trauma, Dr. Jerry Gomez, is here in the house, along with Dr. Clark Simons, who is a trauma surgeon. He looks like one. He looks even handsomer than the trauma surgeons on Grey's Anatomy, straight up. Docs, welcome. Glad to have you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Are you all as sick of dealing with this as residents of Indianapolis are?
Yes. The answer to that is yes. Particularly when we see now that violence, again, is the incidence is going up. In 2013, as you know, the homicide rate went up over 100,
right,
up to close to 130 homicides. And that reflects also not just in the homicides, but the actual victims of shootings, stabbings, and aggravated assaults. So our job, we train to take care of these victims of trauma, of violence. But certainly we don't like to see young people being hurt or killed.
Is it also something where it's given that most of the victims, whether it is a homicide or whether it is an incidence of violence that involves and the victim lives, the bulk of these are gunshot wounds or other kind of weapons. Does it get demoralizing to constantly see young men and Dr. Simons, young men of color, you know, come into your operating rooms?
Well, one of the difficulty things is that, again, I'm African-American, and I have children who are African-American, of course, and family members and so forth. And whenever these individuals come in, they are remind me of my family or who can be my family members. And so, you know, our job is to do what we can and help people and get them better and so forth. But however, you know, it is bothersome that there are so many individuals who are just victims of carelessness or so forth, or who are traumatized. And also, you know, we kind of forget that there are many other people involved, the family members involved and so forth, and how they deal with I had the privilege of going to Vietnam recently, and we're talking about the trauma here and some of the last reports that the United States, we spend about $400 billion a year in terms of taking care of trauma patients, productivity lost. And so this is a major problem.
We spend $400 billion with a B.
With a B.
If people stop shooting each other, we could spend that money on something like fixing the potholes and stuff.
Well, you can fix a lot of things.
239-1310. 239-1310 is that's the news name. Is part of it is sometimes when a victim is younger, because there's a trauma involved when all of a sudden you're suffering from pain, or all of a sudden correct me if I'm wrong, I've never been in this situation. You deal with this all the time. But it would seem to me if somebody suddenly wakes up or is in a situation and they start seeing bleeding and there's a bullet hole in there, how much does shock enter into this, or the disbelief that all of a sudden something that you see on television and you don't feel the pain, or you're playing the Xbox video game and you don't see the pain, all of a sudden it's like, oh, I've been shot and wounded. And sometimes if you're in shock and you can't, you know, get your faculties about you, that could cause the potential, you know, victim to be a fatality. And if I'm not saying that correctly medically, you know, straighten me out, because I'm just an honorary lawyer, not an honorary physician here.
I haven't been shot, and I don't think Dr. Simon has been shot.
I have not either.
But we do talk to the patients, and many of them do mention that after they get shot, many times they don't feel the actual impact.
Right.
And they realize they've been shot when they feel something warm and the clotting happened to be blood. Mm. They do develop pain usually after the fact. But yes, it may look like just a small wound, but that bullet can be injuring one of the iliac veins or the vena cava, and that young person may be actively bleeding inside and is slowly going into shock and eventually die if we don't do anything about it. One of the most frustrating aspects of this is the recidivism. These young people, we fix them up, send them home, and they come back again a second time, a third time, even we have patients seven times. Right, with injuries due to violence, shooting, stabbing. And that is something that we didn't really address until recently in trying to really work as a trauma center, as you mentioned, making this a really a health problem, not just a social problem, but a health problem, and address the prevention component.
Because that sounds like that wouldn't occur in combat, where the same soldier would be wounded six, seven, or eight times. You know, I know it happens, but it seems to me that would be like the rarity on the battlefield. But in the streets, in the battlefield of the streets, that's a norm.
There's a different code out there in the streets. And as our great warriors who defend us, you know, and during conflict, during wars, you know, they get patched up and some of them have to deal with things, you know, a couple of times, but they don't have to go through this. You know, this is different, you know, for a lot of individuals who have been victims of trauma, and then they are still dealing with the circumstances and environment or whatever it is, and then they come back at some point later. And so as Dr. Gomez was saying, this is a major problem, you know, and that we have been making some improvements of that, but it's still a problem that we deal with.
This is another dumb question, but we always talk about post-traumatic stress syndrome among our men and women who have been on the battlefield, whether going back to World War II, Korea, obviously Vietnam was when that first came to the forefront, that issue. And now, you know, with Desert Storm, Afghanistan, and Iraq, is there such a thing as post-traumatic stress syndrome for victims of street violence? Particularly those that live?
Without a doubt. So in our Prescription for Hope program, you know, it's a whole program we do to kind of help these students. But in part of the sessions, you know, where we were talking to our individuals, our victims who we've already patched up and they're back in the community, you know, I'll never forget one of them indicated that, you know, he goes outside and he is still afraid of certain things. And so, you know, he's concerned about the people who shot him coming back and shooting him again. And so he deals, it's different, but it's almost very similar to the things that our war veterans come back from, where they're still dealing with circumstances. And I mean, he even described how certain things just made him remember that time he got shot, you know, and this is something that this individual, and he was really his late teens, this is something he has to deal with or will have to deal for the rest of his life, unfortunately. So yes, there is this post-traumatic stress syndrome that our young kids and any victims of trauma deal with.
239-1310, 239-1310's afternoon's name is it's Your Life Matters weekday two, and we're talking with trauma surgeons from Eskenazi Hospital, Eskenazi Health, Dr. Clark Simons, Dr. Jerry Gomez. 239-1310, 239-1310's afternoon's name is there are a lot of people in the community that are listening right now, not just family members who have either lost someone to violence or family members who were wounded in violence, and just the general community listening. From your perspective, from the medical perspective, from the surgeon perspective, what does this community need to do? In other words, if I gave you all the magic, non-medical magic wand, from your perspective, what do we need to do to really come to grips with this?
That's a very difficult question to answer, unfortunately, because violence depends on so many risk factors. There's so many components that it's just no one element. You see, poverty. Eliminate poverty and then we're okay. Drug dealing, alcohol, All those factors, you add them up, and they are independent, make an influence in the incident violence.
Right.
I think the best medicine is prevention of any diseases. If you prevent the disease from happening, then there is no disease.
Right.
And that has been our focus lately, in how can we address prevention and violence. As you know, we have vaccines for diseases like polio.
Right.
And you get the vaccine, no polio. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there's no an anti-bullet vaccine that we have come up with yet. Mm-hmm. So it is a really a team effort. And one of the projects, as I mentioned, is Prescription for Hope.
Right.
We found out from our friends in San Francisco that this type of approach do make a difference.
Now, this is something where in Prescription of Hope, we're going to hear more of it in our second hour, but basically it's what?
Yeah, it is. That is, we're trying to change and help individuals change their social behavior. Mm-hmm. For the better, of course. And the problem we have is these kids come to our trauma center,
right,
bad injuries. We spend money, hours, effort. We fix them up. And we send them home back to the same environment where the injury took place to begin with. Mm-hmm. So what we're saying is there's something wrong with the environment, something we can fix in the environment for these kids.
Right.
And what we do is try to approach these individuals right the day of admission to the hospital. They're still under stress. They're more susceptible to change behavior, to listen to recommendations during that time. And we do that in conjunction with family members and friends. Mm-hmm. We try to do a diagnosis. What is the problem? Is it alcohol? Is it drug abuse? Whatever the risk factor is.
Right.
So we make a diagnosis and work with the patient, with the participant. How can we help them solve that problem?
239-1310. 239-1310 is the afternoon's name. Let me go to the phone. Start today with Anonymous. Hi there.
Praise the Lord.
Hi.
How y'all doing?
Fine.
Good. First of all, I want to say to the surgeons, thank you so much for the amazing jobs you guys have done over decades here in the city. And also, I was thinking about what is the possibility of marching the suspects or even the victims through the morgue so they can see that it's not a video game, it's not a TV show, it's not a rap song, that they can see what's actually happening to the individuals that they're shooting and killing out here. Thank you. God bless.
All right. There are some techniques, some groups on trauma center have used that. Actually, they bring potential individuals that may be engaged in violent behavior
right
to the coroner's office to see an autopsy performed. We also try to scare them by having people that are paraplegic as a result of the gunshot wound so they can talk to them. And there's some good effect of those tactics. We're learning more and more of other options, like, as I said, Prescription for Hope and similar options that are being engaged not only in Indianapolis, but in Baltimore, Chicago, Oakland, and many other places.
The thing about this program and other programs do is something called that teachable moment. Mm-hmm. You know, and honestly, this started from things we're dealing with patients who were drinking or smoking, and that when they got injured or had illnesses, that's the best time to reach them. And so that's what we're doing in this program. So these are people who are unfortunately victims of injury, that's the time you can reach them, you can talk to them, and so forth. As the caller had said, you know, we have done the morgue program before. When I came here about 14 years ago, we were doing that for a couple of years or so. And I think the thing about it is that I think it works on a small number of students. Because these are basically junior high and high school students that we're working on. We have a bunch of other programs where some of my colleagues, we go and we talk to kids and we show them some pictures and we have some real life scenarios and so forth. So we are doing multiple different venues or events to kind of curb this issue of violence.
Does it? Yeah, as the caller was talking, I was thinking about you know, and we live in a video age and kids are in a video age. Is it even, you know, letting them see some video of you guys actually doing what you do, and then they realize, oh, it's not like Days of Our Lives. It's not like General Hospital. It's not like Seattle Gray. I mean, this is for real. Mm-hmm. It's messy. It's complicated. There's a whole lot of people involved in it.
Mm-hmm. It does help. What happens is it goes away. It doesn't have the lasting effect. Mm-hmm. What these programs that we...
is more holistic.
Not only that, but it was consistent. We go all the way. We make a compromise for life with the participant.
Right.
We have a mentor, develop a mentor that will work with them. Okay. If they don't show up to the meeting they're supposed to, we'll go pick them up.
Okay.
We talk to the parents, the grandparents, the pastors, to get this. What we need is more funding so we can expand this program. We're very limited as to what we can reach.
You know, another thing also is that the successes programs is, you know, even in our moments, that teachable moment, and we talk to these individuals, it's an ongoing process. Mm-hmm. And so the people who work in our program, they work with our individuals basically as long as we can. You know, so we've had students who have been with us for, I say students, but individuals have been with us for a year's time period.
Right.
And during that time interval, things come up, and then we're here to help them up and talk them about things and guidance and so forth. So it's not a one-time thing. It's a long-term event that helps makes changes.
239-1310. 239-1310 is Afternoon's Amos. You can send me an email at praiseindy.com, or you can send me a text message at 37890, keyword Amos, 37890, keyword Amos. We're talking to one of the every time we talk about the problems of crime and violence, you know, people are saying, well, the minister, the church community is important. They're saying, yeah, the men and women of law enforcement are important. They're saying, the politicians have got to be in there. The parents have got to be in there. The community. And we rarely engage in the folks that got to put people back together. The teams of trauma surgeons and the nurses and the guy that puts the gas in you so that you're passed out and you don't have – people aren't yelling. It's a team of folks.
Mm-hmm.
And when we come back, we'll talk about the cost of that, because I'm willing to bet that not everybody they treat is on an Affordable Care Act plan. Which means that if you're a taxpayer, you're paying for this, for these people who shoot themselves up and get patched up. We'll find all that and more. It's Afternoons with Amos after these. 239-1310, 239-1310, it's Afternoons with Amos. So when the trauma center gets the call and the Eskenazi ambulance is on the way and they're calling and say, hey, we got somebody, gunshot wound in the chest, they give you the age and what have you. When they get into your facility, how many people are involved in trying to fix that person up?
So when the person initially comes to our emergency room, there is a team. And so the team usually comprises the nurses. These are about three or four nurses there.
Okay.
There is usually from the physician side, the surgeon. So there is at least staff, meaning myself, Dr. Gomez, or colleagues, and probably about two or three residents.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is our emergency medicine faculty, or they're there as well as their residents, maybe one or two residents that are there. There's usually a respiratory therapist that is there. And so it's not uncommon that when a person comes to a room, there's around, you know, 10 to 15 people that are just there to take care of them.
That's as many as will sit on the Pacers bench tonight or that's on one side of a football team.
Right, and that's just the initial time they come in. And so
that's the initial. That's before they go to the operating room.
That's before they go to the operating room. You know, and so if they do need to go to the operating room, there's another team. There's anesthesiologists, their residents, the nurses, the scrub techs, and then we're going to talk about if they go to the floor, the nurses there, the ICU nurses. And then in our team, you know, there are, you know, the physicians, the nurses, the pharmacists, the social workers. There's a large team that takes care of these patients.
And they all get paid. Kind of, sort of.
No much, but yes.
but we're talking about something that if I saw the bill, could be a couple of $100,000. No joke.
No joke, no. Now, is I would say average a gunshot wound patient costs about $40,000 per patient, and that is just an average. Some of those patients need to stay for months, so we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. Some stay less.
And do we know what percentage of the victims of violence are covered by insurance or not? Because at that point, nobody's filling out a form and worrying about, show me an insurance card. You're solving a problem right there.
Right. And I don't have the number on top of my head right now, but certainly our victims of violence have less insurance than the nonviolent patients. And also, just to mention, is the investment. To be a trauma center, for Eskenazi to have the Smith Shock Level Trauma Center unit, there is a big investment to have all these people to be in-house, ready for that person who's going to come in, have the OR available, have the anesthesia people available, the blood bank, radiology. It's a whole gamma of teams and equipment that you need to pay just to be available. It's like you pay for the fire department.
Right.
There's no fire, but they're there. And if there's no fire, you still have to pay them.
Right.
Well, similar to that is this level one trauma center, so level twos that need to spend quite a bit of money in the institution to keep that going.
239-1310, 239-1310. This afternoon's the Amos. We're with Dr. Jerry Gomez. He is the chief of trauma.
I'm still going back to Grey. You thought that was the cute guy on Grey's Anatomy. No, he's cuter than the guy on Grey's Anatomy.
And Dr. Clark Simons, trauma surgeon. Let me go to Gerald. Hi, Gerald.
Praise the Lord. I'd like to say I give those gentlemen a great round of respect for the job that they do, because it is a very, unique situation they're in, and they're doing a great job, and I commend them for doing their job. Now, as they stated earlier, after they get to fix them up, they turn them back into the environment in which they come from, and sometimes that same individual comes back. Until we just show these individuals, these young people especially, we got to show them the love of Jesus. Nothing they can do to stop us from showing them that love. They got to start from the mayor, the police, the prosecutor. Everybody got to show these young people, they love them and that they care about them. And as long as we don't show them we care about them, they will go back and see things nobody cares. So they don't care about the next individual they run into. And I just think we just continue to pray and show the love to these young people out here to let them know they are loved, they are needed, and their lives do mean something. That's the statement I would like to say. Thank you.
I appreciate that. How important is, I know the medicine is important in healing, but how much of healing is psychological?
It's quite a bit. As Clark was mentioned before, the impact, particularly in the younger population, the 17, the 19, the 21-year-old kids, they get shot for the first time. We do have the older group, the 30-somethings and 40s that have been there, and that may not be a big impact. But I think most of the impact is in the younger people. They have, as Clark mentioned, it's like a post-stress syndrome, a traumatic stress syndrome.
239-1310. What is it? Are there problems getting cooperative, particularly with not so much, maybe with a teenager, but somebody that's 18, 19, 20, 22, 23, 24, when the parents come or the grandparents come? How important is it that that family has some cohesion? Because if the family's not cohesive, or do you even have instances where somebody comes in that's a victim of violence and there is no loved one or kin even with that individual?
Well, it's the family's extremely important, but society is also very important. There are, unfortunately, a lot of individuals who, in the life of crime or causing injuries to others and so forth, that they do feel unloved, they feel no one's taking care of them and so forth. But the thing about it is that when you get to a chance to talk to a lot of these individuals, they honestly are great individuals. They're great people. Mm-hmm. It's just that they've never had opportunity. They never had anyone who's been there to talk to them, ask them how they're feeling, or be supportive of them. We in society, we tear each other down way too much. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we need to spend more time bringing each other up. And you'd be surprised how great some of these individuals are and how much talent they really have.
Is it sometimes, if they're recuperating in the hospital, then you or the residents have, you know, go in there and you're checking on them, hey, how's everything going on? You're checking the charts and the monitoring and stuff, and then the nurses are there. How important is... Or are there instances where those victims are coming in there, and this may be the first time that people have ever come to they come across like I'm here really I really care about you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the main goal of Prescription for Hope. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the family is a problem. Sometimes mm-hmm. the family is a risk factor. Mm-hmm. Father is a drug dealer, for example. Previous criminal records and continues to do so. So this 17-year-old is living under this umbrella of a father who is actually a violent person. So when that kid gets there, the actual secret of this project is to get him right there and then show them that there is help, that there is hope, mm-hmm. that we can do something to help him. I think in many of these kids, they feel frustrated. Right. They come to us, they're all stressed out, and then go back exactly to the same environment, as I said before, that triggered that violence. Our job is try to break those influences that make the kid to get into violence activity.
Is this something, since this is not the only city suffering from these spurts of violence, and Eskenazi is connected with the Indiana School of Medicine. You know, y'all are training the doctors of the future. How are doctors today, particularly those that are going to go into trauma medicine, going to go into emergency surgery, how much are they trained on what they may find in a big city trauma center or a big city emergency room?
You know, so one of the good things about being in this great country is that there are so many different states, so many different people, some people involved. And so, you know, at IU School of Medicine, we do everything we can to teach our students in terms of life, in terms of things that's out there and so forth. And we are no different from any other medical school. You know, we being a level one trauma center, again, there's other level one trauma centers in the state. We're just one of them. And I think one of the requirements now is that every trauma center has to do something for injury prevention. This is something that's governed by something called the American College of Surgeons. This is an overseeing body of all the surgeons, you know, in the nation.
So the medical profession has said the trauma centers, y'all got to do something.
Oh, yeah.
To give back maybe the wrong term, but to try to deal with this.
Yeah. I mean, this is a national problem, you know. And so every state, every trauma center and so forth, they have programs. They may not be the same, but, you know, we model our program after the program in San Francisco. And there's a group of programs, you know, in most of the big cities that we meet nationally about once a year. And we talk about our successes and our stresses and so forth. But, I mean, this is a national problem, mm-hmm. you know. And so the society, we have to realize this is a national problem. This is not just something that happens on one respective area or one respective street.
Right.
This happens everywhere. You know, you have victims of trauma in every part of society. Mm. And so we have to address this as a societal problem. So from the physicians, we are doing everything we can. We're trying to teach our residents, our students, so forth about the problems. So that they themselves, when they get out there and they're practicing, they're also prepared to kind of help deal with these issues.
But let me just say that, indeed, this is relatively recent. Mm-hmm. The effort from the faculty and the students
right.
to engage in prevention, particularly violence prevention. As I said, at the college, which is our main organization, requires that.
Right.
And something recent. We pride ourselves to take care of the injury. Mm-hmm. How to fix it, and we teach how to fix it, how to operate, and then you feel proud and you save somebody's life.
Right.
And then we stop right there. What we're saying more lately is we got to keep going beyond that.
239-1310, 239-1310. We're with Dr. Jerry Gomez and Dr. Clark Simons with the Smith Level 1 Shock Trauma Center at Eskenazi Health, Eskenazi Hospital. one of the things, because I'm hearing you talk, and given that your industry, and when you're part of the medical industry, which is the emergency trauma, and there may be people hearing the word trauma and they may not understand what that really means. Is it fair to say this is a center in a hospital that's designed to handle the most serious injuries and the most egregious things that could happen? A tornado tears through the field house, and you've got a mass casualty, everything from mass casualty situations to gas, and goodness knows what else.
Yeah, I think you have a point. Many people do not understand what the difference between a trauma center and a non-trauma center hospital. Mm-hmm. We have good hospital with excellent ERs.
Right,
they're not trauma centers. So, if the medic that goes to the scene, or whether it's a shooting, stabbing, or a car crash, and the medic determined that the patient is a major trauma, mm-hmm. he will take that patient to the closest trauma center, right. even if you have to bypass a non-trauma center good ER.
Right.
And the reason is, as I explained before, that we have dedicated staff and equipment just waiting for that patient.
Right.
The others have not made that commitment. Mm-hmm. And trauma is injury. And it can be blunt, which is car crashes, falls, or penetrating, which is the violent one, the stabbings and shootings.
Right.
And it can be major trauma. Mm-hmm. You cut your finger cutting tomatoes at home.
Yeah.
You are a trauma victim.
But I'm a trauma victim.
Right. But we're not going to send a helicopter to take you to a level one trauma center.
Oh, if you thought I was going to pay the $250,000 bill, I think you would send a helicopter. 239-1310. Is there angst among families who worry about how am I going to pay for this?
I think there is. I think that there is a lot of concerns that people have, what happens to me, and so forth, whatever. But I can tell you from the hospital side, mm-hmm. our responsibility is to take care of the patient. Mm-hmm. And so we never do what we call the wallet biopsy or see what a person's insurance or they have or not, and so forth.
Right.
We can care less about that. And so when patients come, to our facility, as any other level one trauma center in the nation, whether you have this amount of insurance or you are living in the streets or whatever, we can care less.
Mm-hmm.
We will worry about that money aspect or the business people, the office, they'll deal with that stuff for later. But our main goal is to take care of you, because you can't, if a person's not saved, well, they can't pay their bills. So we want to save people's lives because that's our responsibility. We need to help. We want to help people.
In any kind of community-wide collaboration to try to deal with this, the medical community needs to be a part of that.
Absolutely.
Because mm-hmm. I get the sense that whenever we're sitting, well, all the big people are sitting around saying, well, we got to have the church here, and we got to have the politicians here, and we've got to have youth here and youth agencies. They kind of leaving y'all out.
Yeah. It is something that somebody said once, the white coat effect. Mm-hmm. When you talk to a 15, 16-year-old and you show up with a lab coat that's curled. I mean, there is an image of the medical profession.
You all have street cred, as the kids, as young people would say.
Yes. We'll have an influence
okay.
on that person.
Mm-hmm.
They will listen to not just the doctor, but the nurse in the scrub. There is some sort of respect mm-hmm. to the profession. And when we get them, in the stress,
right.
when we get them in that teachable moment situation that Clark was talking about, that's ours.
Mm-hmm.
Church doesn't have it. The
right.
Street doesn't have it. We do.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to work together with the church and the street mm-hmm. people and the government
right.
to help us address that patient in that particularly important moment.
The thing is that everyone has a responsibility for this.
Mm-hmm.
So the churches have responsibility, the families, everything. We're part of the solution. So, I don't think any group can be excluded in this.
Mm-hmm.
We all have to partake in this because this affects everyone. More importantly, this affects our children.
Right.
You know, I have two children. They're my loved ones. You know, they're my babies. And as Dr. Gomez, everyone else has children. And no one wants our child to be a victim of injury. You know, no one wants that. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we all have a responsibility to get together and talk about things to see what we can do to make things better.
Dr. Jerry Gomez, the chief of trauma at the Smith Level 1 Shock Trauma Center at Eskenazi Hospital, Eskenazi Health, and Dr. Clark Simons, trauma surgeon at the same Smith Level 1 Shock Trauma Center. Do I get a dollar for every time? At Eskenazi Hospital, Eskenazi Health. Guys, thanks very much for being with us. When we come back, an ortho surgeon. No, that's not somebody that puts the stuff in your ground so the flowers grow. It's another kind of ortho, because when a bullet goes in, it doesn't just hit skin and muscle, it hits a bone, and all kind of crazy stuff happens. And we'll talk to the ortho folks and a lot of other folks coming up. It's Afternoons with Amos, and in our final half hour, we'll remember the late, great Maya Angelou, called home today at the age of 86. All that and more. It's Afternoons with Amos after these. Welcome back. Dr. Brian Mullis is ortho trauma surgeon at the Trauma Center at Eskenazi Health. Smith, I'll mention Smith's name enough. Doc, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Appreciate you having me on the show.
So, you know, we were talking about, you know, what is a trauma center? And from your perspective, what is it? What do you do?
Well, did you ask me two questions there, or specifically just what I do?
Both. Okay. Two questions.
A trauma center can mean different things. Mm-hmm. In many states, Indiana included, there are what we call verified American College of Surgeons trauma centers. And so this means you have to meet certain criteria mm-hmm. to call yourself a trauma center. And there's different levels.
Right.
So even a community hospital can serve a very good purpose by delivering initial care to a trauma patient, mm-hmm. but they would be a lower level, like a level 3 trauma center, mm-hmm. as opposed to a level 1 trauma center is typically where you have residents, teaching, research, and all the clinical capabilities to be a very active trauma center.
And a level 1 trauma center is also if a world leader is here, if the president or the vice president is here and they stub their toe, they're coming to you.
So that's part of what's called the CAPITAL program, and that's mm-hmm. run by the American College of Surgeons. And that goes beyond just being a level 1 center. There's a trauma center that's designated as the center for the CAPITAL program. Mm-hmm. Eskenazi, because we essentially have our own police force, is a very secure hospital. You know, we do deal with a lot of crime. It's a very safe place to come. And so not only does that help keep us safe, the physicians and nurses, but if there's a world leader here, they would go to Eskenazi if they were injured, and we take care of them.
We didn't mention this before, but part of the trauma center is, you know, sometimes when you're taking care of these victims of violence, they're the person that did the shooting. And they come to you, and they're under arrest, but you got to take care of them. Is that extra danger for the team?
I don't think I'd say it's extra dangerous. I think all of our law enforcement personnel do a very good job of essentially disarming that patient before they get to us. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm military as well, and it's the same protocol. There's basically some type of area outside the mm-hmm. hospital itself mm-hmm. where whoever it is, whether it's enemy prisoner of war or here, a civilian combatant, so to speak, who's disarmed first. Frankly, even some of the worst criminals behave themselves around us, because if you were a criminal, would you want to piss off your doctor?
I mean, No.
You're not going to get many pain meds if you're upsetting your nurse.
Are the lessons that we have learned, particularly the past 14 years mm-hmm. In medicine, in the military, mm-hmm. are those lessons being applied here so that we could have had 200 homicide victims because of the way medicine is today or the way the bullet went in or didn't go in, we have far less than we might have because of the lessons maybe learned on the battlefields of Iraq and Afghanistan the last 14 years in medicine?
There's certainly information that's shared on both sides, frankly, because they're really not in isolation. There's many doctors like me who serve, and not just doctors, nurses, you know, all kinds of ancillary personnel who serve in both. There's no question that we have learned lessons from especially blast injuries over the last 10 to 12 years mm-hmm. That we've applied to help patients survive and even including our burn units. You know, mm-hmm. we have a burn unit at Eskenazi Hospital, too. And so the blast injuries are a little bit different in the military than what we take care of at the blunt and penetrating in civilian, but there are things we can learn from both that help help us care for that patient.
Is a patient more at risk if their injury involves injury to the bone, which comes into your specialty? Because ortho doesn't mean the thing that you put into the ground and make flowers grow. That's bone stuff.
Right. So Dr. Gomez and Dr. Simons are lifesavers, the guys you just talked to. There's very few things I do to save lives. A few. Mm-hmm. A bad pelvic injury. The pelvis is where you're where your hip bone attaches to your spine, basically. So so if those are severe, that can kill you. If you break one of your legs, you're not going to die from that. You break both your legs, you could be in trouble if there's a delay to getting to the trauma center. But for the most part, I'm the limb saver. And so Dr. Gomez and Dr. Simons are the lifesavers.
Because they're dealing with chest and veins and heart and lungs and all that kind of stuff.
And orthopedic surgeons also deal with spine, but my primary focus is on the extremities, the arms and legs and the pelvis, where the hip joins the spine.
Are there more of those kinds of injuries when we're dealing with the victims of violence, or is it more in chest, head?
For what we call penetrating injury means knife, gun, arrow, something bizarre. Right. But for penetrating injury, that always involves Dr. Gomez and Dr. Simons. And I would say many times it involves me, especially if it involves an extremity. But if it's isolated just to the head, chest, or belly, I'm not involved in those cases. As opposed to blunt trauma, if you get hit in your leg or hit in your arm, you may very well just be treated by me and not be treated by one of the lifesavers like Dr. Gomez or Dr. Simons.
When you see young people, whether they're teens or young adults, people in the flower, the phrase used to be the flower of their youth, coming in there, how do you deal with it?
Well, it can be tough. You need to have some separation to really focus on the patient. If you get too, you don't want to be completely disconnected and just be a cold doctor, but you've also always got to keep the patient's best interest at heart and not become so emotionally attached that you can't make a decision.
Right.
And that sometimes can be a tough, fine line to walk. To answer your question, sometimes we don't deal with it well. I mean, certainly I've stepped out of a room because I was too emotionally involved and needed to take a few minutes to prepare myself to then go back in and take charge of the situation. You know, it's especially harder for young physicians as they're learning. I don't mean to sound like we get calloused as we get older, but we just become more experienced and more used to dealing with that, just as in any profession, dealing with high-stress situations and making tough decisions.
Is it hard then for the students and the residents that are there from IU because the learning hospital for them is Eskenazi? Is that harder for them, or that is the opportunity that separates the doctors from the ones that suddenly decide, maybe I need to go sell insurance?
Hopefully that decision has been made before you get to that point in the hospital. I'll give you an example. My first patient was my cadaver in medical school. So before I was even exposed to human patients, that's very tough to cut on a live human body, even though the patient's dead. That is usually the first separation where a lot of us figured out, is surgery in the mix for us, or do a lot of folks went into psychiatry or pathology, things where they didn't necessarily have to deal with the surgery.
Right.
No matter what you do in medicine, obviously you have to deal with people, but I think most physicians are people's people one way or another. And there are certain specialties where, like in radiology, you're dealing more with other physicians than you are patients themselves.
From your perspective and the perspective of your profession, because again, one of the things I think all of us in Indianapolis are trying to grapple with is, how do we put our hands around this? How do we reduce your caseload so that you can go out and go to the movies and watch whatever's the big summer movie and eat a lot of popcorn and pig out rather than do what you do? From your perspective, what do we need to do as a community?
Well, I think it's a great question, and obviously it goes well beyond medicine. The community needs great mentors. You know, the basic unit is the family unit. Parents need some type of mentor, hopefully a mom or dad, to to help them through life. And if they don't have a mom or dad, then hopefully somebody else can step up, whether it's a foster parent, a minister, someone in the community to help mentor these children so that they know there is a future for them. Things beyond the immediate problems they're dealing with in a daily life, that there's hope that they can get an education and do something they enjoy.
Are some of the victims of violence in our city that you've had to treat ended up without a limb? And they've ended up with an injury, because unlike something that's in your chest, there's no outward sign necessarily on a chest injury that there was an injury. But if all of a sudden you lose a finger, or you lose an arm, or you lose a leg, or there's something traumatic with a traumatic head injury, that's something visible. That's something that's kind of permanent. Is there a lot of that in what we're dealing with here? What I would call those kind of injuries.
You're asking specifically for trauma, and that's less common. I do a lot of amputations, but most of it is for medical needs. In other words, you've got a bad infection,
right.
Your life's in danger because of the infection. That's the majority of the amputations I do. Mm-hmm. It becomes somewhat controversial for trauma patients because most trauma patients are young. And so the controversy becomes when we have what's called a mangled extremity, should we try and salvage that limb knowing it will never be normal? Mm-hmm. Or should we just do an amputation so the patient can move on with life? And the reason it's controversial is the limb salvage takes multiple surgeries, a very long hospital stay. Generally, the patient is left with some residual pain and can result in years before they're basically over that injury. As opposed to an amputation, fairly quickly, you can get on with life. But there are barriers to that. Some patients have trouble accepting amputation as an option and mm-hmm. want everything done that can be done to salvage a limb. Other cost barriers are we used to think it was cheaper to do the amputation because you're out of the hospital faster, but the prostheses are so expensive. Mm-hmm. Generally, somewhere around 5 to 7 years, it actually becomes more expensive for an amputation than limb salvage, despite the multiple surgeries and longer hospital stays. So it is somewhat controversial.
Have you had the experience of, a patient that you've had, a victim of violence, and you hear from them, a couple years later, or they're the ones participating in Prescription of Hope, and all of a sudden you hear from them, and they say, hey, I'm doing fine. I haven't gotten back into trouble. I got a job. I'm doing great.
Yes, and frankly, those are the reasons we're in medicine. There's certainly many great stories out there, folks, whether they're injured by crime or just bad luck, who are success stories. And, mm-hmm. and those are the reasons I show up to work every day. Mm-hmm. That makes it easier for us to deal with those situations for folks who aren't as successful in avoiding further trouble. And I see those patients back too, who continue to come back from, crime-related type activities.
239-1310, 239-1310 afternoon's names with Dr. Brian Mullis from the Smith Level 1 Shock Trauma Center at Eskenazi Hospital, Eskenazi Health. We'll take a break. We've got some more folks as well. And coming up in our final half hour, we will remember a unique individual, literally one of a kind, Dr. Maya Angelou, who passed away this morning at the age of 86. This afternoon's with Amos after these. And tomorrow, the police chief will be here. The public safety director will be here. It is a community that's tomorrow. Community conversation on crime. Oh, that's going to be off the, y'all know that's going to be off the hook. Anyway, 239-1310, 239-1310. This afternoon's name is Dr. Mullis continues with us. We're joined now by Wendy St. John. She is the trauma program manager. And we're also joined by Diana Creaser, and she's the program manager for Eskenazi Health's Prescription of Hope that you've heard earlier about. Ladies, welcome. Doc continues with us. So, Wendy, what is a trauma program? We've heard about the docs. So what do you do?
So I have a nursing background, and I work alongside with the physicians and the specialty care that's provided to our trauma patients that come through the hospital.
We know every trauma patient is treated the same, with the same level of care, the same love and respect. Or is there a little extra TLC included if somebody has been the victim of violence?
Well, we certainly have services then that we can provide for them, like Prescription for Hope, or other services, social services that can be provided for those patients that would meet the needs. So the medical care and the surgical care is unchanged, but some of the social needs that those patients have are different than some of the other patients.
Diana Creaser, for people that are just tuning in, that weren't with us in the first hour and heard a little bit about Prescription of Hope, what is it?
Prescription for Hope is a specialized program that takes the Eskenazi Shock Trauma Center and joins our trauma staff with other programs across the country to provide violence intervention services to those who've been injured via violence, gunshots, stabbings, assaults that come into the Eskenazi Hospital.
So let me use a real-world example. Joe gets shot at 10th and Meridian Street. And, you know, the Eskenazi ambulance picks him up, takes him over to the shock level one trauma center at Eskenazi Health. Dr. Simons, and let's say not only he had a chest wound and a bullet hit him in the leg, so Dr. Mullis had to treat him and all the other people had to treat him. But then you guys start to find out that maybe this just wasn't an accident. Maybe, you know, somebody got ticked off at him or they mistook him for a gang member or whatever. How then would Joe get involved in Prescription for Hope?
Well, we have a team of staff who are dedicated to this program as well as trained in violence intervention and prevention strategies. And so either clinical staff would alert us or we would know via clinical records. So at that point, once the patient was medically stabilized, then someone would actually go to the bedside of the patient and talk with them as well as with the family members about what happened and introduce Prescription for Hope and what we actually can do for them. We call it making life-saving and life-changing choices.
What are some of those things that could help Joe and his family?
Well, our trauma team, as well as other trauma teams, believe that violence is preventable and that it's tied to risk factors that are built into their everyday lives. So following getting to know the patient and some of those risk factors that are always present, then we really start tackling them one by one and working with the participant. We set goals and we connect them to community services providers. And then most importantly of all, our support specialist really establishes a close, what we call an up close and personal relationship with that person, because the relationship becomes key to connecting them to the kinds of services that make a difference.
Wendy, and maybe to some degree, Diana, is there, because there are certain, you know, medical privacy rules, the HIPAA Act that a lot of people that are listening are familiar with, are in dealing with the victims of violence, is sometimes there tension between the patient, particularly if the patient is of an adult age, is over 18, and the parents, and particularly in the African American culture, extended family, who, you know, are pressing the medical staff and the doctors for information, and you all have sworn not only the Hippocratic Oath but the HIPAA Oath that only, you know, certain people get the information. Is there a tension inherent in what you all do that family members say, "Can't you tell me what's going on with Joe?" Well, no, you're not Joe.
Yeah, we abide by those same regulations, regardless of what brings them into the hospital, and so are always we always maintain the privacy of the patient.
But is there a tension between family members that want to know and you can't tell them because of the rules?
Oh, I think certainly, and sometimes that tension comes from they want to make sure their loved one is okay.
Right.
That's the first thing, and that's information that can be shared. You know, that they're at the facility and their condition, but other things cannot be shared unless we have the condition of the patient. I think some of it, too, the social side of it, then you recognize during this traumatic event that you have to recognize what some of their coping mechanisms are. Mm-hmm. So as we see these patients, they were previously happy, healthy, and not expecting to be a patient in the emergency department. And as they come in, they're going through that grief or coping of what their injury, what injury has occurred in the emergency department, in the trauma center. And they may not be interacting as they would in their everyday processes and may need some help with coping and dealing with that anger or interaction with family members. It's not only parents, but grandparents or aunts and uncles that come to the bedside and see them as well, and their social circumstances that brought them in.
Are there instances, Doc, where a patient that's a victim of violence, particularly somebody, say, 18 to 20, 24, that's legally an adult in terms of HIPAA and all the medical rules, but may not be fully understand when they make a decision? I'm not to say they're not intelligent. I don't want to mean it that way, but maybe are not fully cognizant of that. Is there difficulties when that patient is the one legally that's got to make that decision on treatment?
Sure. It happens all the time. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have protocols to deal with that. So as you might imagine, many trauma patients are unable to consent for themselves because they've been injured. We may have intubated them, which just means we put a breathing tube down to help protect their airway and help breathe for them. Obviously, if there's immediate family members present, we would speak to those immediate family members about their condition and get consent for any emergent surgery needed. But if there's no one present, we're not going to waste time. We're not going to risk the patient's condition or life by trying to find family members when minutes matter. Mm-hmm. And so, and everyone agrees with that. So we basically would take care of that patient, assume consent, and as soon as we can find family, of course, we would update the family what's going on.
If you see evidence that maybe a family that has rushed to Eskenazi trying to find out about their loved one, and you, in talking, you kind of see that maybe it's dysfunctional. Maybe the family is arguing, well, no, I got to make a decision. Is that when maybe prescription for hope needs to get involved?
Well, I think certainly with the patient, that participant that comes into Prescription for Hope, we recognize that the people that surround them are also important in their lives. Mm-hmm. And so for them to be committed to changing their life, they have to have the support with their family as well. And so there is, and Diana can probably speak to it, there is sometimes some mediation between, especially our older participants, that we can talk through those scenarios with the parents or older family members with the patient. Certainly we can help with that.
Are there instances, Diana, where the victim is rebellious? The parents, the relatives, even the friends, maybe their peers want that individual, hey, you need help, and it's the patient, the victim is, hey, man, I can handle this.
There certainly are. Usually those individuals who are not really anxious to make the kind of change that's required, if you really enroll in the program, will, you know, they'll back off. But we largely have a great deal of family support for Prescription for Hope. In fact, most of the time, you'll have the families really encouraging the young person to enroll in the program. Occasionally, though, you'll find that the young person says, "I don't want to change that much."
What does involve in Prescription of Hope, what part is the program only when the patient is at Eskenazi? In other words, once Dr. Mullis and the other doctors say, you can go now, what happens then?
We see them out in the community. And actually, the bulk of the work of our team is not hospital-based. Okay. It's community-based. We always see the victim of violence in the hospital, at least as much as possible. But once they're discharged, that's when our real work begins, because it's out there, actually meeting them in their own environment, that we spend our great deal of time. So,
what do you do?
Well, we actually we begin with what we call a screening interview, and that is just the beginning of a process that builds as we gather more and more information in terms of what we would call, in the hospital setting, an assessment, so that we get to know as much about this individual and their lifestyle and their family, because those tip us off or give us predictors and cues of how to build a plan. Then
what happens is as you're doing that assessment, as you're talking to the victim, mm-hmm. and say, doggone it, I'll be glad when I get up out of this bed. I'm gonna go and get my Glock, and I'm gonna find so and so that shot me, and I'm gonna take revenge.
That's a definite part of what we do, and that's to really try to prevent retaliation. Mm-hmm. And that's a strong piece of these kinds of programs. And, of course, immediately we begin, you know, talking through with that individual in terms of what are the consequences of that kind of a choice. What will that mean to you, and also what will it mean to the family?
What about the victim that knows who harmed him? So I'm using Joe as an example. Joe knows who did it. Joe is afraid to tell law enforcement because yes. Joe is afraid of retaliation. And this is going to come up tomorrow when the chief and the public safety director is here. Safety for people who fear danger out in the real world. Obviously, you hear that in Prescription for Hope. Is there anything you all can do to influence law enforcement? We don't have witness protection, but some kind of way to protect folks to be able to testify and do what they need to do so the real bad person gets locked up.
Well, we hear that all the time, that code of the streets. Mm-hmm. And what we call it is reporting, and what those folks call it is snitching. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult, I think, to increase the understanding of the youth who've been involved with the violence in terms of why it's so important that they share the information they have about who committed this crime and how to prevent crimes such as this in the future. But it's also important for us as a mainstream community to understand that the code of the streets and what goes on in those neighborhoods, no matter how much we protect them, it tends to create for them a sense of feeling very vulnerable. So there's certainly a need for understanding on both parts. We spend a great deal of effort, though, working with that individual to encourage them to trust law enforcement, to trust us, which they generally do, and to really cooperate in every way they can with law enforcement.
239-1310 is afternoon's names. We're with Dr. Brian Mullis, Wendy St. John, Diana Creaser of Eskenazi. We'll take a quick break. We'll be back with our remaining moments with them, and then we'll remember the great Dr. Maya Angelou. It's afternoons with Amos on a very busy Wednesday. We're continuing day two of our Your Life Matters week, talking to the men and women in the medical profession, specifically over at Eskenazi Hospital, Eskenazi Health. We've talked to the trauma surgeons. We now have the trauma program manager, Wendy St. John, and Diana Creaser, program manager for Prescription for Hope. And this is a program that works with victims of violence and trying to work with them and their families so that they don't come back in the hospital again. Or if they do, it's going to visit another patient, not for them to come back in for the same reason they were in there the first time. 239-1310. Diana Creaser, when Dr. Gomez was here, now he's, you know, the chief of trauma. So he can say anything he wants to because he's the chief of trauma. And as he was talking about Prescription of Hope, he says, we need more money. Where does the funding come from?
The funding originally came from the mayor's crime prevention grant funds. Mm-hmm. And that fund has continued to support us substantially over the 5 years we've been in business. Mm-hmm. So far, our funding is split between Eskenazi operating funds,
right.
So the hospital supports it, as well as the crime prevention funds. And then actually donors, private donors, have made donations to the Eskenazi Foundation. And those funds support us in what we call barrier busting for our patients and families. And that's to cover a variety of fees and costs for them. So it's a mixed bag, and other grants.
If this program is working, should it be implemented at the other major hospital emergency rooms? Because not every victim of violence ends up at Eskenazi, even though you'd like them all to end up there. Some of them end up at IU. Some of them end up at community. Some of them end up at St. Vincent's. Francis. Should the hospital community come together and this thing gets rolled out to other facilities?
I mean, certainly it can be. It would be a hope that we can continue to prevent these injuries. Mm-hmm. So not only reaching them as they come in as a patient, but before that injury even occurs as right. well. Mm-hmm. And those can be done throughout the community as well and at other facilities. There's a national network, and I think Dr. Simons referred to it, of other hospitals throughout right. the nation then right. that have programs very similar to ours that are tailored to their own community. And so we've done that here in Indianapolis. We've started that program and tailored it to our community and to our patient population. And we have shown that it works. And so we hope to continue to do that in the community.
What kind of training does staff have to get for Prescription of Hope to understand the culture of the patients and their families you're dealing with? Because you're dealing, you know, the victims of violence are predominantly African-American, predominantly people of color, predominantly male. So how do you make sure – cultural competency is that big fancy 85-cent word, but how do you make sure – that folk understand those things, you know, like code of the streets and all that kind of stuff.
To work,
is there extra training that your staff has to have?
There is extra training, but even before you get to that point, Amos, mm-hmm. it really starts with a chemistry that you cannot read about on a resume or in an application. And when we meet individuals or interview someone for a support specialist, also known as violence intervention specialist, there's just a chemistry there that it has to come from the heart. Mm-hmm. This is not the kind of work that you could say, I'm going to go to my job today. So it's in your heart. It's in your life experience. It's in your worldview. That doesn't mean that you have to have, you know, lived every piece right. of this life,
right.
but there are just a variety of life experiences that cause you to be absolutely connected and in touch with what these young people describe.
Are any of your team members either former victims of violence or maybe former ex-offenders?
Yes, they are.
Okay.
Yes, they are. And in fact, we, as the program has grown, because where we started 5 years ago and where we are now, because actually Prescription for Hope is an umbrella now, while the core still serves victims of violent injury who come in through the trauma center, we have several other programs that branch out under that same umbrella. And we also serve the perpetrators of youth violence. Mm-hmm. So at this point,
is there a different skill set to be able to deal with the perps?
Actually, they're all one and the same.
They're all one and the same.
The victims, and one of the things that we know from even our own IMPD data is that homicide victims and homicide perpetrators have the same criminal backgrounds and history. They're identical. And the overlap between our victims of violence, so the youth and families who come in that way versus those who come in through referral from our community partners, there's an overlap. So many of our perpetrators have had a violent injury, and many of our individuals, with over half of them who come in with a violent injury, have a criminal history.
Is there any desire among perpetrators, I want out of this, I would like to not do what I'm doing?
Yes. I mean, it's not always quite as crystal clear as that.
Okay.
Some of that is, again, caught up in the age and who they are mm-hmm. and the bravado.
Right.
But it doesn't take very long to peel that away and get to the core of what these young men, who they are, what they're really about. And as I said a while ago, the answer is in relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's in oftentimes crime is committed by individuals who are outside the rest of community, or at least they perceive themselves to be. So the goal is to bring them into law-abiding social community and to put them into relationship with adults that they can count on, with adults they can trust,
right.
and to expose them to pro-social law-abiding life in the community.
When the chief and the public safety director are here tomorrow, we're going to be talking a little bit about domestic violence. That seems to be on the rise. It's disproportionate African-American, both at the victim side and on the perpetrator side. In Prescription of Hope, are you also dealing with, you know, victims of domestic violence? Does that make it a little more complicated?
We do. Mm-hmm. I mean, we deal with all types of violence. And that's part of, and maybe Dr. Gomez spoke to this, mm-hmm. but part of what our team is also trained in is something called trauma-informed care, and recognizing that the life experiences of these young people, and often the same life experiences of their parents, are steeped in traumatic kinds of events. Poverty, family violence, racism, death, gun violence, you know, all kinds of traumatic life experiences just in the neighborhood, if you will. And that kind of trauma that just builds up from the time you're a very little child mm-hmm. all the way up to the teenage years takes a real toll on your decision-making, your critical thinking, your taking of risk, your ability to even see the future differently. And that happens with parents, too.
Diana Creaser, Wendy St. John, there's a lot of people in the community listening to you right now, community leaders, pastors, moms, dads, grandmas, grandpas, maybe some folks who have lost loved ones to violence. What can the community, from your perspective, I mean, you're seeing this every day. And if you had the magic wand to wave, what would you want this community to do?
I think that we need to continue to embrace these individuals in our community and make them feel a part of the community. I would like to see them before they're injured mm-hmm. As well, to hope so we don't escalate, allow for crime or for injuries to escalate. Mm-hmm. Because some of our participants, this is not the first time they've been injured. And mm-hmm. each time they come in, their injury worsens potentially. Right. So to continue to help embrace them and be a part of the community so they can be successful. With the age group, I think it's important to encourage them to their education, mm-hmm. to stay in school, to reinforce those positive the right. positive outcomes that they can have through their education as well.
I would reiterate what Wendy just said. The single best tool that we can give young people in our community is education. And anything we can do to keep them in school and help them get the most out of that educational experience is critical. The other piece, though, I come back to connection and relationship. And some of the literature talks about creating small communities of concern.
Right.
And that is something we can all do. You know, reach out and touch someone up close and personal, whatever it means to you. Faith communities, standing in the margin with the people that are around their churches, all of us, to be connected to each other.
If people want more information about Prescription for Hope, how do they find out about it?
They should contact Eskenazi Health, our website at www.eskenazihealth.edu,
okay.
or they can call 880-3547.
Wait a minute,
547, and that's the prescription.
Wait a minute, start again.
880.
Oh, that's right. He got an
880-3547.
3547.
Prescription for Hope Office.
Prescription for Hope Office, or just go to eskenazihealth.edu. EskenaziHealth.edu or 880-3547. Diana Creaser, Program Manager, Prescription for Hope. And Wendy St. John, Trauma Program Manager. Ladies, thanks very much for being with us. Glad to have you.
Thank you.